It's Christmas time, and I wanna see Santa Claus. Yes, it's Christmas time, and I wanna see Santa Claus. Gonna ask him for my baby. Ain't that a real good cause? He was my loving baby, and I love him oh so strong. He was my loving baby, and I loved him oh so strong. Oh, Mr. Santa Claus, his arms are where I belong, where I belong.
Good. It's not bad. Not a bad way to start off a morning when you start with Ella Fitzgerald. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is the 22nd of December as we hone in on the holiday. And we're having a lovely holiday season. I hope you are as well and enjoying all that they offer and making the best of it and being safe in the process. Well, we have a terrific show for you today, and I say that only because we have a really great group of panelists. And also, we have some really good topics to discuss as well. So stir, mix, enjoy. It all should be good. Let's introduce everybody. A quick reminder that you can join in on the conversation. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. And we'll include your letters. We won't get to everyone, but we'll do our best. We'll work through them. Panel@WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, my friend. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Always wonderful to talk to you. I'm not so well. I've been obsessed by yet another psychological impediment.
Okay.
This one is I can't get Tommy Tuberville out of my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
I mean, 6 years of that.
Tommy Tuberville, who believes we fought socialists in the Second World War and, you know, things of that kind. But also because this the strangest thing that is happening. Tommy Tuberville is, because of his friendship with the president and all of that, going to vote to challenge the election results. And that is going to kill all his Republican colleagues who don't want to vote one way or the other for or against Trump. Get it? So therefore, because he's doing that, he has really endangered his Republican colleagues, which in my mind is something they deserve. They should absolutely be able to vote one way or another and be forced to vote one way or another. So Tuberville, who is such a what's the right word? You can't use one word, but here's the other one that Steve Allen always used. He's such a smuck that... No.
I thought you were going to say kiss ass. Go ahead.
No, such a smuck. That he is doing the right thing for the wrong reasons as usual, and there you go. I can't get Tommy Tuberville out of my mind. And this morning, I said the only thing that would be better is if it turned out that Tommy Tuberville played the tuba.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah. So yeah. I went to my special Google. And I asked, did Tommy Tuberville play the tuba? Unfortunately, it was not able to tell me.
No, he played football. That was a coach. I don't know about the tuba. Now, do you think it would be different if he was Thomas Tuberville? It wouldn't probably be as good, right, comedically?
Well, it would be approaching it, but it would not be the same thing as Tommy Tuberville.
Yeah.
Tommy Tuberville, and by the way, I looked him up, and he's not, you know, stout.
He's a fit guy.
He's sort of svelte.
Yeah, he's an athlete. That is who he is.
Some athletes do go to pot literally and figuratively.
Well, that's true. He's 66, I think, 66 years old. So, we're going to talk about Georgia, and we'll talk a little bit about the president's antics, and I'm sure Mr. Tuberville will come up once again. Mike Spain is here, former Times Union associate editor. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm great, all dug out and ready to chat with all you guys.
Excellent. Yeah, it took a while, didn't it?
Yeah, a couple of days.
But here we are. We're good. We can see. That's good. Our good friend Teresa Bourgeois is here, Cohoes City Director of Operations, which means she had not only had to worry about her plowing, but of the entire city of Cohoes. I assume you had to worry about that.
Well, I did worry. It wasn't my primary job, but I did choose to worry about it, and they all did the best they can in a historic storm. But so, Alan, you can't get Tommy Tuberville out of your mind. I can't get the Alvin and the Chipmunks Christmas song out of mine. I was looking up the, on this day in history just to see if anything interesting happened, and it turns out on this day in history it was number one on the music charts, and once you start thinking about that song, you can't forget it. So.
No, and the fact that at any time in our history, see, we think things are bad now, but at one time, that was the number one song in America. Maybe times were worse then. Yes, that could be.
A long way from Ella Fitzgerald.
Well, that's for sure. That's for sure. Are you familiar with the Chipmunk song, JP?
I love the Chipmunk song, and if it's stuck, there's a lot worse things I could have stuck in my head than the Chipmunk song, right? I mean, that's a pretty good one, no?
Well, it's true. You're absolutely right. JP Miller is from the Empire Report. He is the Empire Report. He's the man that makes sure it exists, and it exists because of him. And we are thrilled to have him with us on our program this morning. All right, let's go and start talking about what is making news. We have a lot to talk about, a lot to figure out, a lot to go through, and we begin. So we start with a story that broke late last night, and the New York Times broke it, that the Treasury Department senior leaders were targeted by hacking. The disclosure was the first acknowledgement of a specific intrusion in the vast cyber attack. At the White House, national security leaders met to assess how to deal with the situation. You will remember that over the weekend there was some question as to, well, there wasn't question, but there was Mike Pompeo who said, look, this was the Russians. This was the Russians. And then the president came out and said, we don't know that. We don't know that. It could have been China. It's probably China. So now we're dealt with in reality world, they're trying to figure out how deeply Moscow, not China, but Moscow, burrowed into the Trump administration's networks. In a statement after briefing for committee staff member Senator Ron Wyden of Georgia, who has often been among the sharpest critics of the NSA and other intelligence agencies, said that the Treasury Department had acknowledged that the agency suffered a serious breach beginning in July, the full depth of which is not known. The Treasury Department ranks among the most highly protected corners of the government because of its responsibility for market-moving economic decisions and communicating with the Federal Reserve and economic sanctions against adversaries. The senator said the hackers had gained access to the email system by manipulating internal software keys. The department learned of the breach not from any of the government agencies whose job it is to protect against cyber attacks, but from Microsoft, which runs much of the Treasury communications software. The senator said that dozens of email accounts were compromised, apparently including in what is called the Departmental Offices Division, where the most senior officials operate. All right, Alan, go ahead.
Well, with all of the junior geniuses that we have in our country, 12-year-olds who can encrypt, decrypt, and all the rest of it, it's extraordinary that this kind of thing can happen. When asked about it, President Putin, I don't even know if he was asked about it, but he was somewhat defensive about it, and he said, "Niet, no, not us. We never do that. That's clearly just the United States trying to get at us." What, with the president that we have right now, with his relationship with the Russians? That's extraordinary. Now, I think it was Bolton the other day they had on CNN. It may not have been. But it was one of those guys, and he's saying, no, he has lots of criticism for Trump, but there's no question, nothing's really going on with the Russians, that's just paranoia. Oh, really? as Mario used to say. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Teresa.
Well, I'm not anywhere close to an expert in the technology, so that part of it I don't understand. But clearly, you know, they left the door unlocked. The Russians came in, been rummaging around, putting cameras in, essentially taking I think we're going to learn closer and closer look at our operations. And I think this is very, very serious. What struck me as I was reading this was thinking back about how often Trump was denouncing our national security operations and how distracting that must have been to them. Now, not suggesting that they shouldn't have been focused on this, but you think about, you know, the last 4 years of him often denigrating them and what a drain that must have been on the system, where then and now he's not focused on how serious this is. And so yet again, incoming President Biden, you know, this is just one more crisis they're going to have to deal with, the health care crisis, the economic crisis, the crisis of, you know, repairing our democracy, and now this just unprecedented espionage.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, when I was reading this latest story about the cyber attack, I had some deja vu, because Trump, like he did back in last January, was playing it down, saying we have it under control, it's not that big a deal, and he was trying to blame China. So this is apparently a mode of operation. And, you know, he is, as you pointed out, Teresa, he's largely checked out from the presidency, except for, you know, trying to pull off a coup or a military takeover or something like that. But he just isn't involved in any of this. And then he throws out these, you know, out of left field, trying to blame China because he hates China, and apparently does not hate Russia.
Yeah. JP.
When I read about this, I thought to the interview I heard this year with Edward Snowden, who was a contractor at the NSA and, of course, is now under the protection of Russia. And he talks about how exposed we are and how we continue to be. If I were these intelligence agencies in the United States, I would always be under the assumption that both the Russians and the Chinese and probably three or four other governments are always in our systems reading, what we're writing to each other and reading our files. And, you just hope that our government is smart enough not to put into writing a lot of our secrets and all that kind of stuff. But I'm also surprised they got caught. It's not like, you know, you leave muddy footprints in the bank when you're robbing it. Like, you know, how do they even get caught?
Well, my understanding is they stayed around too long, right?
Well, you get caught by Microsoft. They employ a lot of people, yeah. and they're the ones who did it, who saw it, and who, just like when your bank messes up, you hear from your bank, right? They tell you. You say, yeah, we messed up. We want you to know. Everything you ever owned is now compromised, and we're sorry.
Yeah, Microsoft had a flaw in their system, and the Russians exploited it.
Well, there's a lot of finger
pointing. So does Microsoft get in trouble for this or no?
Well, Microsoft is blaming the Texas-based software firewall company. And they're all talking about how it happened. But the sad part is that nobody knew it happened for a long time. And if you were, you know, as you say, Joe, if they got out the door and kind of closed things back up, who knows if they ever would have discovered there had been these breaches.
Right.
Yeah.
This company, FireEye, is the one that it identified that as a problem.
Right. It was in their software updates, though, wasn't it? I mean, you know, we can get into the minutiae of it, but, you know, the system didn't work.
Well, that includes Teresa saying, FireEye, I'm in.
Well, they're the ones who discovered the problem. And they're the ones, this security company, FireEye, is the one that discovered the problem. And and alerted them, and then they traced it back to this, as I under, again, I am so far out of my depth here, but as I understand from trying to read about it, that Microsoft realized that they had a flaw that was exploited, and now they've closed that door. But
it's not only Treasury, right? I mean, we don't know the extent as to the cyber attack of what has been attacked and what information was gleaned from this operation.
The State Department was one of the ones attacked. Yeah. I mean, think about that.
And there was a meeting. Yeah, there was a meeting at the White House yesterday, and they were saying that if you want to know what agencies were probably most, you know, intruded upon, just look at who was there, the Energy Secretary, Commerce Secretary, Treasury. And that gives you a sense of who was probably attacked. But they feel it could be anywhere throughout the system. And the other
and
thing
I believe
is
the
that,
president. Yeah. I was just going to say, I don't think the president was at that briefing. I mean, this is how checked out he is. It's just not an issue for him.
Let's hold there. And when we come back, we'll continue. We'll have we have letters. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Teresa Bourgeois, and J.P. Miller make up our panel. And again, we do welcome your letters. Keep them short and to the point, but we'd love to get to as many as we possibly can. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation first. We have news from the BBC, and then we'll be back right after that.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh, and every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 35 minutes past 9 o'clock on this 22nd day of December, and we welcome you to the conversation panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Teresa Bourgeois, and J.P. Miller make up our panel. We have letters on what we were just discussing, which is the cyber attack, the hack, if you will. Edward writes, the software attack was spread by adversaries cracking the passwords at SolarWind and inserting a malicious payload in their software updates to clients. SolarWind is broadly used, up to 18,000 clients per press reports. FireEye, a computer security firm, was hacked, and many of their software tools were stolen. That update from Edward. We go to Vincent, who says, as a layperson who is not very tech savvy, I'm always amazed how good these hackers are. We have the greatest minds in the world, people with PhDs in computer science, and these foreign entities are still able to penetrate. It really is impressive and extremely concerning. Then Sean says, is anyone thinking Trump directed the back door to be left open? Anyone on that?
No.
You do not think so, Teresa?
I don't. You know, I just don't think he has the wherewithal on that, actually. I think this is just standard espionage that they just succeeded at, and why they succeeded at it, I don't know. But, you know, is it but I think this goes on all the time, and the U.S. has to be much more vigilant. The government systems are very, very old systems, and we need to focus. I mean, there have been hearing after hearing about this for a long time, that the U.S. needs to be much more vigilant about its computer systems.
No, I don't know. If I were president of the United States, I'd be sitting up there and saying, you know, just as we all anticipate problems at WAMC, you know, we are hearing about this. I want to make sure, I want to be assured that we are doing everything we can to make sure that this didn't happen. Now, do I believe that Trump is behind it or that he's smart enough to have thought it up? No. But do I believe that he's in bed with the Russians? I do. And I have thought so for a long time, as you all know. And therefore, I'm not one bit surprised that he's quiet about the whole thing.
So let's talk about a stimulus for many Americans. The coronavirus recession has done almost no damage to their finances. They still have their jobs and their expenses have gone down while they've been stuck mostly at homes. Their homes have not lost their value, unlike during the financial crisis of 2007, 8, and 9. If they are fortunate enough to own stocks, their portfolio is probably worth a little bit more than it was a year ago. Of course, millions of other Americans are struggling mightily. 9 million fewer people are employed than 1 year ago. Others are coping with big medical bills. Many small businesses have closed or may soon. State and local governments are planning deep, deep cuts. So enter the $900 billion stimulus bill that Congress passed last night, which will provide a lot of help to the economy. But many economists believe that it is also filled with major flaws. Among them, it isn't especially targeted at the parts of the economy that need the most help. A central part of the stimulus, a one-time check that the government will mail to people. Any household with income below $150,000 will likely receive at least $1,200. Families with children will receive more. Much of that money will go to Americans who are doing just fine and who will save the money they receive, which in turn will do nothing to keep the struggling businesses afloat or keep workers employed. Already, the personal savings rate had risen to about 14% from 8% at the start of the year. There's a lot here, and I would just like to begin with one aspect of this from Steve Mnuchin, and talking about that this money is based on your tax returns from 2019. And of the money that will be given. So if your income is below $150,000, now my understanding, and please correct me, panel members, if I've gotten this wrong, but my understanding is it's based on your 2019 tax returns. Well, many people, as noted in of what I just read, there were many more people who had jobs who do not have jobs now. So if the money isn't going to them who lost their job in calendar year 2020, it's based on what your income was in 2019. So even the people who are really struggling as of now because they've been out of work, say, since March, this will not help them if that total has gone down below, perhaps substantially below $150,000. Mike, is that your impression?
Yeah, no, I that's exactly how I understand it. But I'm not that concerned about that aspect of it. It means that somebody who might have made more than a couple that made more than $150,000 in 2019 and put that on their taxes might be in very bad shape right now, and they won't be getting this $1,200 for the couple. You know, that's less descriptive of what's really going on. What you have is a lot of people who are making $20,000, $25,000, $50,000 trying to take care of families, and they're making virtually nothing now, and they're going to get $600. And that's not going to be much at all. There needs to be a sustained program to help the people who are hurt the most. And this seems to protect the people that did okay before. I mean, it's I don't know how you do it. It's a 5,600 page document that most people say they haven't read, even though they voted on it to approve it overwhelmingly. And the details will kind of roll out. Hopefully, there's some we don't know about yet that actually will reach the people who need it the most.
But according to the New York Times and David Leonhardt's column this morning, much of the money, quote, much of the money will go to Americans who are doing just fine and who will save the money they receive, which in turn will do nothing to keep struggling businesses afloat or keep workers employed. Already, the personal savings rate has risen to about 14% this fall from 8% at the start of the year. Teresa. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I think that for the reasons that you say and for the reasons that Mike says, that the $600 checks, there are lots of flaws to that. But for some people who receive them, it will be a lifeline, albeit a small lifeline. And for some people who get it who might not need it, if they spend it locally, then that can help with the economy very much. You know, if they go and spend it at local restaurants, local shops, that will make a significant difference, though it's, you know, not a lot of money. But I think there's also a lot more in there. There's money for small businesses, which they claim they will do a much better job at targeting this time. It was not targeted well at all last time, though that is not without its challenges because of the tax implications of receiving the money. But there also is money in there for schools, for some child care, for some higher education. There's rent protections, although I'm not sure if there's any protections for the small landlords who are suffering as much as the renters in this situation. You know, there's the Save Our Stages money for cultural institutions. There's, you know, there is 11 weeks of an extension of unemployment benefits. So some people say, well, it's only 11 weeks. That's true, but at least it is 11 weeks, and that is a lifeline for people, and also more food assistance. So something needed to be done. This is, you know, there's lots of flaws in it, but hopefully it will at least help.
Alan, and of course, one of the big concerns is that with this, then it creates problems down the road for, like, this is okay for now, but then we need something bigger in the new year. But what political capital will the president have to actually deliver and to bring people what they need, especially considering, even as it was, it took from June to December to get this particular package?
Well, first we'll say the obvious, which is that it all depends on Georgia, because capital will change. What he needs will change. Then there's the second thing that nobody seems to be talking about, you know, and that is the question of economics and how much a Coke costs these days. Joe, I know you don't drink Diet Coke anymore, but how much did one of those cost the last time you had one?
Well, if you buy them single, they're, you know, what, $2, $2.20, $2.30?
Can you imagine?
Yeah. Wow.
Twice as much and a nickel, too. That's how old I am.
Yeah, I think it's 2 for $5 some places, and that's a deal. So it's probably even more than that, like $2.79, something like that.
Yeah, that is unbelievable. So that $600 today ain't what $600 was. And that is something we have to consider. Not only that, Teresa, to your point, and it's kind of interesting, there are an awful lot of people who've been thrown out of work, who had good jobs. And Joe, to your point, they had good jobs. They were making a lot of money. Now they're making nothing.
Right.
And so one has to wonder. CNN had a woman on the other day, or yesterday, I think. She was crying. She was an accountant, and she was in a car, and she was on her way to pick up food. This is a horrible situation.
And, Alan, I think the people were about to fall off a fiscal cliff in the sense that the unemployment benefits are running out and the rent relief is running out. And I think this is a bridge. This is, I think, why the incoming Biden administration was so focused on helping getting this done. And I think this is why it did get done, because I think this will help forestall a real economic collapse. And it gives them, you know, to 11 weeks or more just to get in there and see what else can be done.
You're certainly right about that. And one doesn't have to look further back than 1929 in order to understand what the potential for total breakdown in a depression would be. Right. And this country is never going to let that happen again if they can help it. And if that means becoming socialists and sharing and making sure that everybody has bare minimum, you won't see soup lines. Well, though, wait a second, you do.
Yeah.
I mean, you see an awful lot of people.
You
see an awful lot of people lined up for food.
You do. And, well, Mike Spain, go ahead.
Just to underscore, this is temporary. The question I think you asked was whether Biden has the political capital, even if Georgia does not go for two Democrats, to push this through a divided Congress. It sounds like as soon as he's inaugurated, he's going to push for another stimulus package, one that would include aid to state and local governments at a level much greater than the little bit that's in there now. And it's whether he can get it through. Some people say this shows that, bipartisanship works. But that's pretty cynical to me. It shows that, as you said, Joe, 6 months they've been working on this bill, and they finally get it through because they were shamed into it. And I don't know if Mitch McConnell's going to let anything else go through if he remains the Senate Majority Leader. It sounds like this is going to play out kind of messy after Inauguration Day.
You know what, Mike? He may not have the same clout. McConnell, because he's going to have a Democratic president. I don't think we can forget that, who has a great deal to give out to even Republican states, United States senators who are going to want things for their states. And they won't have the millstone of Trump around their necks. I think that's true, the way that they have it now.
Yeah, it'll be complicated. Whatever bill gets through will include all kinds of other stuff, just like this one does. And, you know, it just won't be easy. It's gonna be a groaning process.
I do need to take a break. Go ahead, Teresa.
Sorry. It definitely won't be easy, but it also will make a big difference if you have a president who is using his bully pulpit, as he did here, to try to move things forward. And I think that will be a major difference. And the moderates in McConnell's caucus are going to gain power, and that's what needs to happen.
Absolutely. And
real quick, before we go to break, anything you want to add, JP?
I would love to talk about the other side of the break, if that's okay.
Absolutely. We'll do that, and when we come back, JP Miller, live and unfiltered. We'll be right back.
Sleigh bells ring. Are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight. Walking in a winter wonderland. Gone away is the bluebird. Here to stay is a new bird. He sings a love song as we go along. Walking in a winter wonderland. In the meadow we can build a snowman. Then pretend that he is Parson Brown. He'll say, are you married? We'll say, no, ma'am. But you can do the job when you're in town. Later on, we'll conspire.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. And J.P. Miller, the floor is yours.
On the relief bill, the Daily News today said relief bill too little, too late, but better than nothing. And I thought it was interesting that the MTA got $4 billion. The MTA is clearly in dire need. And Chuck Schumer is kind of forced to both defend this stimulus, but also say we need to do more. You know, Chuck Schumer has done some chest thumping, saying New York's got getting $54 billion in pandemic relief, but also in the same article said, quote, clearly there's more to be done. This is not a stimulus bill. This is a survival bill. And yesterday in Governor Cuomo's press conference, he says, you know, the states asked for $160 billion in state and local funding, and they got zero, absolutely zero. And that's where, you know, New York has a $15 billion budget deficit this year and probably another $15 billion next year. And I think, you know, assuming that the Republicans win these Georgia runoffs, you're all of a sudden going to see these Senate Republicans all of a sudden become fiscal hawks and say, you know, we don't want to spend money. We're spending too much money, where when Trump was in, they're happy to spend like drunken sailors. But I can see them becoming more fiscally conservative once Biden gets in.
No question.
JP, I mean, it clearly the Biden administration, incoming administration, is signaling that they're going to focus on two things, I think, to juice the economy. One is an infrastructure bill, and the other is a clean energy bill, which will address clean energy issues, but I think that's really their jobs bill. Do you think that the Republicans can turn their back on either or both of those?
I wouldn't put it past them. I think that it's going to be tough. You see, this bill that just got passed is going to be a bipartisan bill, but it's one that people, no one's so excited about it, right? It's kind of watered down. It's kind of like what Schumer called it. It's a survival bill, not a stimulus bill. And
right,
it'll be interesting. It will be interesting when Biden gets in. You know, he's going to have his first 100 days. What is he going to focus on? Is he going to focus on another stimulus bill? Is it going to be the infrastructure? Is it going to be clean energy? What's it going to be that he's going to put the big push towards? And I don't think we know that yet.
We have letters from many listeners on the subject of stimulus. Andy writes, my wife and I are lower middle class but live simply. Like last time, we do not need the stimulus. So like last time, we'll be donating it to the organization that need help, and like a food shelter. There must be many more like us. I urge them to do the same. We also go to...
Cheers to them. Exactly right.
Eric, who writes, yes, people who lost jobs due to the pandemic will not necessarily get the one-time payment with it based off 2018 income. However, those that have lost good-paying jobs this year will get $300 unemployment benefit. After a month, they will have gotten their $600 plus an extra $600 and continues to receive additional stimulus. I don't understand that letter, and I don't think it's correct. Does anybody know?
Well, the $600 would be the stimulus payment, and then the additional unemployment, you know, would add up over, you know, the 11 weeks that it's continued. And you know, they'll get something, is I think maybe that the writer is saying.
Okay. But the unemployment is not retroactive, correct? For the many months that was not available, the extra money, that is not retroactive.
Oh, right. When did that run out?
I believe June or July. July.
Oh, the additional $600.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see. Let's go to Susan. Do landlords get a reprieve as well as renters? Who pays these mortgages? Asks Susan.
That's a very good question. And, you know, yeah. One knows that there are people like you and me and everybody else who have invested their life savings in, you know, a B&B or running or renting an apartment out. So it's easy enough to point the finger at them and say they're bad people, but they're not. They have to make a living. They have to go forward like everybody else does.
And, all right, let's see. We go to, I'm trying to look up, while I'm doing this, I'm also trying to look up the unemployment information because I'm trying to figure
well,
that
didn't,
out.
Didn't the extension, I mean, it was going to run out after Christmas, and this extends the regular unemployment and then adds the 300 to it, but it's,
I think that's right, Mike.
Yeah.
And it may be a state-by-state issue as well. What I've wondered is for the people who previously exhausted their benefits, you know, so it depends on when you became unemployed, but there's some people who previously exhausted their benefits, but mm-hmm. they're still unemployed. So, but they can't, I don't think that they can access this, but I don't know for sure. And
that's interesting
because unemployments are run by states. Systems are run by individual states.
We go to Mary Alice, who says, my brother was furloughed from his hotel management job in mid-April, and his unemployment, which in Florida caps at $275 per week, try living off that, ran out at the end of July. He was finally officially laid off from his job after 20 years with Marriott in mid-November. Can the panel comment on whether any of the extended unemployment will be retroactive for those whose benefits expired in July? Well, that's what we were just talking about. I have to look up. I'll look into that during the break. But my understanding is that none of this is retroactive, meaning that whatever money you did not get from, say, July to November, you will not get retroactively.
You will not get that back. No.
Which, I think the reason it's a question is because when we were talking about other stimulus packages, new stimulus packages in the summer, that was part of it, whether or not that we would continue that and then it would be retroactive. But now, since so much time has passed, it obviously will not be. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. Well, here's one more letter on the stimulus, and then I'll go to a break. Mike says, while people saving will limit the effect of the stimulus, it will not reduce it to zero. The fact is, the lower in the economic chain you go when you provide stimulus money, the more effect it has. That is because lower income people must spend more of their income to survive. This is why supply side economics has no benefit at all. Enough of this money will be spent to have a great effect on the economy. That from Mike. We'll take a break. We will take this conversation and continue it on the other side of the break. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring, ting, tingling too. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Outside the snow is falling and friends are calling you. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Giddy-yap, 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 let's go. Let's look at the show. We're riding in a wonderland of snow. Giddy-yap, 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 it's grand. Just holding your hand. We're gliding along with a song of a wintry fairyland. Our cheeks are nice and rosy and comfy cozy, are we? We're snuggled up together like two birds of a feather would be. Let's take that road before us and sing a chorus or two. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Teresa Bourgeois, and J.P. Miller. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. We heard from a listener. This has nothing to do with what we're talking about, and I normally don't go to letters that are off topic. But I just want to read this one, and you'll probably understand why as I read it. This is from T, who says, what the heck is going on with the USPS? I've never seen this level of failure with any of my Christmas packages. It's not like Christmas wasn't on the calendar. DeJoy, the new COVID spike, what is going on? Now, as we know, people love to talk about the weather and they love to talk about the post office. So, and complain about both. But
yeah, there is an explanation that I guess 16,000 postal employees called in because they've been exposed to coronavirus or they've tested positive. And because of it, on top of everything else, it's just completely devastated them.
Go ahead.
I love our mailman, Bobby, our mailman. He comes every day. He gets out of his truck and he gives Murray a cookie. Or a dog cracker. And he's a wonderful man. And I asked him the other day, because I see him out there in that truck, I think at 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:30, and he says, we're working all day long.
Yeah.
So, and he said...
Yeah,
and
I would turn it around on the writer, saying, you knew that Christmas was coming for how long? You knew for 11 months that Christmas was coming. Get those packages in the mail. You knew... That, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. We've got snowstorms. We've got all this stuff. Get those packages in the mail. You can't expect around Christmas time to get your packages there at the same time that they are the other time. I agree. Our mailmen and women are working around the clock. I feel like they should, when they die, they should be buried at Arlington Cemetery. I think they're heroes, what they're doing for all of us to get our, you know, socks and garbage that everybody's sending around for gifts. I mean, I'm amazed at our postal workers.
Well, and the other thing, too, is, and I echo everything everyone has said, but I have to say that we do know that there was, as this letter even says, I mean, they have a new postmaster general who worked very hard to get a lot of stuff changed. That caused some problems. That caused some mistrust. And to JP's excellent point, usually they always said, you know, please have your packages in the mail by the 15th, and that way we can comfortably guarantee that they'll arrive on time. And this year they said, please do it, you know, 2 weeks earlier than that, because we have such volume. There's only so many of us. There's only so many trucks. There's only so many planes. There's only so many modes of transportation to get your package from one end of the country to the other. So, I don't know. If you spend 5 minutes in your local post office, you will come out feeling extremely sorry for them. I don't know.
I agree. They look exhausted. They look, you know, distraught. And I mean, I saw one woman, a customer talking to a woman behind the counter at one of the local post offices last week. And the postal worker started to cry. We've tried to get help, but they can't send any, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
They are beat.
Yeah. And they have all of the other, and I hope everyone will take this in the nature that I mean it. But, and then they have all of the stuff that, because it's a government agency, there's all the normal stupid government stuff they have to put up with on top of it. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, FedEx. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. FedEx doesn't have to worry about a lot of that stuff.
Right. So, you know, there's a thing about, you know, you can't drive the truck. You have to put the truck in the back of a trailer to get it from one place to the other. A lot of steps put in there that make it more difficult. Teresa, you were going to say, I apologize for interrupting.
Yeah, this is not the failure of the frontline workers, as everyone's saying. They're doing an amazing job in a very difficult situation and, you know, putting themselves at risk. But this is a failure of leadership that began a long time ago, you know, and this is why you don't hire amateurs for a top job. And, you know, this administration, there's news today about the census and the troubles, the rippling effect of that, you know, the damage that they've done to the post office. I mean, imagine how deep the problems go with this administration when you damage the post office so in such a way. So many of the systems of our government have been harmed by this lack of attention. And how much attention did the Trump administration give to this? They could see this coming, and they gave it no attention. They created the problem, and then they didn't work hard to try to fix the problem they created, and here is what we're left with.
So I didn't mean to pile on the letter writer, but by the same token, look, you have two more days. Hopefully your packages will arrive on time.
Eventually
you'll get your L.L. Bean neck warmer in the mail. You will get it. Maybe not. It may not be under the tree, but at some point you will get your pair of gloves.
What do you do if it doesn't come in time? You get a picture from the catalog, you put it in a little box, and you put that under the tree. Done.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And then,
you know, it'll be more like Hanukkah. We'll get gifts every day after Christmas because they'll be coming in the mail.
I'm good with that. Keep them coming. That's fine.
I want to know that my neck warmer is coming in the mail, JP. Is that a guarantee?
Well, order it up.
I want one of those.
Okay, let's move on to other topics. We can. It's always when you have to use like the starting fluid on the engine. If you ever need that in radio, just talk about the post office. Boom. All right, let's go to some other subjects here. I want to talk about the. There was an interesting article. I thought this was an interesting article. I don't know what you all will think, but I welcome your thoughts on it. This was in the Washington Post yesterday, and it is titled simply, Why Americans Are Numb to the Staggering Coronavirus Death Toll. The subtitle being, Death is Everywhere, Yet Nowhere in America During the Worst Stretch of the Pandemic. And this is something that I know has bothered me and my wife and so many of us, I think, as we talk about this. But as the article says, death is now everywhere and yet nowhere in America. We track its progress in daily bar graphs. We note its latest victims among celebrities and acquaintances. Yet, in many parts of America, we carry on debating holiday plans, the necessity of mask mandates, how seriously to take the virus, whether it's all a hoax. In the face of one of the biggest mass casualty events in American history, we are growing increasingly numb to death, experts say, numb to the crisis and tragedy it represents and to the action it requires in response. Something happens in let me just one more thing and then I'll turn it right over. Something happens in the brain when fatalities reach such high numbers, say psychologists who have studied genocides and mass disasters. The casualties become like a mountain of corpses that has grown so large it becomes difficult to focus on the individual bodies. And with the coronavirus in particular, experts say the deaths have been hidden from sight, even from friends and family, the human cost sequestered in hospitals and nursing homes. Alan.
Well, you know, part of this is that we have resorted to statistics. We say this many people died, this number of people died. Now, some stations and television stations and others, and the Times, I believe, have tried to take that and to pull it apart and parse it and say, okay, this is one of those numbers. This person had a face, a family, and died. And I think that that's part of our problem that we have here. But you know what? There is this question in many people's minds when they read these terrible statistics. Yeah. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? I mean, how can you possibly deal with this? And so we have Dr. Fagan on, and we got one or two, not many. We got a lot of very positive letters. One or two letters saying, okay, we know all of that already, and it's very complicated, and why do you have to have him on? Well, you have him on because he is telling us what we need to know in this country about our development and where we're going.
I do think the media has done an admirable job in the most part as far as trying, as you said, Alan, of taking out moments to introduce us to people who have passed as a result of the virus and give us their backstories and try to put a face to it as much as possible. I think of what the Boston Globe did of printing obituaries on the front page of the paper when we hit, I think it was 100,000 deaths. I believe that was the case. So certainly there have been attempts, but overall, it does just become for many it becomes a number and something that the way we deal with it is to block it out and especially because we can't even fathom. But we're hitting last week, as we will this week, basically one 9/11 every day as far as the number of people who have yeah. perished.
Yeah.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, I was going to say one statistic that I just read was that if everyone were to adhere to wearing a mask in public, 131,000 people will not die going forward. That's how big they measure the death toll to be in the coming months. And we can cut that by 130,000 people if we would wear a mask. And you know, that's one of the first things Biden is going to call for when he's inaugurated is a 100-day wear a mask, pledge. And it's got to become, I don't know. You know, it's just got to become the way we live. The other thing, and I'll say it quickly, is Elizabeth Rosenthal, you know, the medical journalist, the brilliant medical journalist, says it's time we start scaring people. We can't just try to get public service announcements saying, hey, wear a mask, be good, belong. When people are scared and they really understand the impact of it, like New York City does because of March and April, they begin to just adhere, and that's not happening across the country. And we got to, I guess, as the media has to scare people by telling the truth, the terrible truth that's out there. Show the caskets, show the funerals, and frankly, I think they are. And it's a tough one to people turn it off. That's the problem.
Well, you know, we talk about it every day on the program, and we talk about it. In detail every day, almost every day. And I had a conversation with a very good friend of mine who had coronavirus in March and was hospitalized and was on a ventilator and was then released. And I saw him in the grocery store on Saturday. And, you know, he's still feeling the effects. And I was so struck by that I don't think we know. A lot of this, of course, you have the president goes out and he has the virus and then gets this world-class treatment and is better and is running around the country and doing all the things and as if nothing happened. And then we keep hearing this line about it's nothing worse than, you know, it's no worse than the flu and how many people die of flu. We got a letter like that this morning and another one yesterday. But for a lot of people who have it, it's continuing, and it continues to wreak havoc on their bodies. There's so much we don't know, as Dr. Fagan pointed out yesterday. The other part of this article, and I would really I would invite people to check it out because it's really fascinating. But there's a part of the article called "The Arithmetic of Compassion," and it makes the point that hundreds of thousands of people in Rwanda were murdered in the space of weeks by soldiers and militia from a rival ethnic group. And in response, the U.S. and much of the world basically shrugged it off. Bill Clinton later said that his administration's failure to act was one of his great regrets during his presidency. But that triggered a psychologist by the name of Paul Slovic to conduct experiments to better understand people's reaction to mass suffering and death. And what he found was really troubling because in one study, his research showed people a picture of a 7-year-old girl dying of starvation and asked for donations to help her. He showed another group 2 starving children, then even larger sets of children. And Slovic found people's distress didn't grow with the number of children in danger. Instead, it shrank. Mm-hmm. And that is really troubling, and I don't know what we do about it, but it does come to this numbness that occurs in people when they are facing something that is too grim. Teresa?
It's a defense mechanism.
Go ahead, Michael.
I mean, it's a defense mechanism. Right. It's your body reacting. I mean, how many of you don't feel numb at times when you hear it day after day? But it's being able to rationalize your action away from your emotions, and that is a challenge.
Yeah, I think there are multiple layers to this. I think part of it probably is, I'm not a mental health person, but I think part of it probably is a defense mechanism. You turn away and you turn to the Hallmark Channel because you just can't cope with it anymore. But part of it, I think, is that we live in a country where people watch 2 different sets of news, right? And they get 2 different sets of information. And for a very long time, you know, the people said over and over again, it's just like the flu, it's a hoax, it's nothing. And for some, they, even despite the numbers, that's still the view they have. I can't tell you the number of people who say to me, oh, it's, you know, it's really not a thing, it's the flu, it's just like the flu. Well, no, it's not even close to just like the flu. And this issue of long-term COVID, I think, needs a lot more attention to it, because there are so many people that, you know, we rightfully focus on the number of people who die, but the number of people who survive but then are sick over a long-term period, you know, we're getting more and more understanding of that. The question is what to do about it. And as the article also pointed out, because the hospitals are closed, you know, so many people are dying alone, so that you don't go through the typical rituals of a lot of people coming to a funeral, or, you know, people there at the hospital coming to a funeral, sharing in the grief. And so there's a distance from the death in this instance that you don't have in other cases. Mm.
Yeah.
I think it's a really complex issue.
Laurie Peake, who directs the National Hazards Center at the University of Colorado, is quoted in this article. She's in Boulder and said that if you think about the disasters that have captured the attention of the nation, like Hurricane Katrina, that news crews can show the devastation and people just automatically open up their wallets. But she makes the point that this pandemic isn't camera ready like that, because instead of being a single discrete event like the Twin Towers collapsing, this has unfolded. It's often invisible, it's slow creeping, and it's chronic. And over time, our brains just gradually tune out that danger, which is really something. Also, to your point about the hospitals, Teresa, if you really want to get scared too, which was one of the things that Mike said that we ought to, you know, start scaring people. Helpful in that is there was a map. I haven't checked the front of the last night. It was on the main page, the homepage of the New York Times, but it was a map,
right,
that showed where what your local hospital was dealing with, and gave, I think, up to date figures as to how many beds they had available, and ranked them as far as what their load was in when it comes to those or who are in intensive care. And if you look at it just locally within our region, there's a lot of red and a lot of pink, which means that the beds are scarce. And also in places, very small, some hospitals that have, say, you know, smaller hospitals that have, say, 50 beds, last week had 25 patients and now have 75 patients just in the matter of 3 days. And that has really come to it. So, you know, you think, Mike, to your point, you think things like that scare people. And yet, you know, maybe it's just another statistic that washes over them. I don't know.
But, Joe, don't we also see this with gun violence? You know, because there are certain incidents like Sandy Hook that get tremendous amount of attention, as well they should. But the day-to-day deaths involved with gun violence just do not get that same attention. And while these numbers are higher, I think there's equivalency in that. But there definitely is the whole fact that people won't wear a mask, where, as Mike says, those numbers are so clear, they say them over and over again, that you could save 100,000 lives in the next 3 months if more people would just wear a mask. Yet they won't. Yet they're clamoring for vaccine, which is important, but you could save lives right now. Just wear the mask when you're around people.
JP?
Yeah, I wonder why President-elect Biden won't implement a mask mandate. I'm kind of surprised by that. I feel like that's something that everybody could agree on. I also, in talking about the numbers, Joe, you know, I watch Governor Cuomo's press conferences every day that they're on, and now in New York State, we have over 100 fellow New Yorkers dying every single day. And I'm not criticizing the governor, but he, you know, reads the number and he does show emotion and remorse about that. But it's hard to, because every single day he's got a number like 120 or 130. And it is striking to me that we're now at a point where he says that and maybe I don't have the same emotion as I did back in March when he first said that number, you know. And I think that we're all talking about how humans are, you know, becoming a little desensitized. And one other thing I wanted to mention is that I tend to see more mask wearing, more vigilant mask wearing in more affluent areas and less mask wearing in less affluent areas. And that might just be my perception. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe the studies don't bear that out. But it's just something else where you say, why is it? It seems like the mask should be such an easy thing to do. It's like, you know, we all wear socks. Why don't we all wear the mask?
Right.
And I'm amazed by it. Even still, you see a lack of mask wearing.
There are three chilling paragraphs in this article from the Post, and I do want to read them because they just, I think, for all the reasons that we just mentioned, it's important to. This is the, and I want to give credit to the author of this because it's really good. And that would require my mouse to. It's by William Wan and Brittany Shamus, who have written this. And they write, "This is what death in the pandemic looks like up close. Patients often grow ashen as their body struggles for nutrients. Their skin becomes mottled with splotches of reddish purple as their heart pumps less and less blood to parts of the body that need it. Often the room is eerily empty, with nurses and doctors trying to minimize risk of infection. The only constant is the low, steady hum of an oxygen compressor piping air to the patient's nostrils. Amid the silent void, the patient's dying breaths become magnified. Again, that from an article in the Washington Post today, which is called Why Americans Are Numb to the Staggering Coronavirus Death Toll. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters from listeners. We'll move on to other topics as well. And we welcome you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org.
Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh. O'er the fields we go, laughing all the way. Bells on bobtail ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Now the ground is white, go it while you're young. Take the girls tonight and sing this sleighing song. Just get a bobtail nag, 240 for his speed. Then hitch him to an open sleigh and crack, you'll take the lead.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. It is the 22nd of December. It's 34 minutes past 10 o'clock. We have about 15 minutes together left in the panel, and we'll get in as much as we possibly can. We got a lot of try that again. We got a lot of letters on the subject we were just talking about in COVID and death, and how we process it as humans. So I would like to go to some of those. Kathleen writes, cameras in hospitals to show us what these people are going through would certainly help bring the message forward that this is real and we can curb it with mask wearing and social distancing. I'm sure it's not possible, but it would be a punch of reality. Those pieces do exist. They are out there, I know. They're hard, obviously, because of the patient privacy for the patient and also for the safety of the crews. But I know they are out there and they do exist. Brittany says, if you want to scare people, give them the facts. Cuomo has done an excellent job at sharing facts with the people of New York and across the country. The fact is influenza kills 34,200 Americans in 2019. COVID has killed 320,000 in less than 1 year. We go to Edie, who says, hello, panel. The number of COVID deaths are overwhelming. I think the human race has developed coping skills to deal with so much death. It's only the last 70 or 80 years that we've got a handle on most illnesses. Before that, dying was a normal part of being a family, and everyone experienced it firsthand. We should not think too poorly of ourselves for coping, as we are genetically programmed to cope. Let's see. This,
well, we don't want to lose empathy.
Right.
You know, coping is one thing, but denying is a whole other thing. And so often, you know, I've heard a couple people say, you know, people just don't get it until they actually get it, or someone they love gets it. And that's the frustrating thing about this, the number of people who say, you know, it's not a thing, or it just makes older people sick, as if that's okay. And then they put not just themselves, that's not a choice just for themselves, it becomes a choice for everyone around them, because it has implications. Them not wearing a mask, them not taking precautions, puts everybody else around them at risk.
A retired Navy intelligence officer wrote to us and said, to quote a master of killing, Stalin, one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. We also go to Amanda, who says, I just wanted to draw attention to the distinction between the kinds of numbness Americans are feeling. There's numbness from apathy, which manifests itself in mask flouting and conspiracy theories. But there's also a really intense numbness for those of us who are overwhelmed by the magnitude of the grief, fear, and frustration of living through a devastating and disgustingly politicized pandemic. There's certainly something to be said. And as you were talking about earlier, both Alan and Teresa, about the mental health aspect of this, of course. Chris said our country should have an official national mourning program. There are so many ways to do this respectfully, authentically. The federal government should go to the Ad Council for assistance. Herb says PBS NewsHour does a wonderful job every Friday in memoriam of everyday people. Yes, they do. I would note that CNN does as well, and I've seen it on CBS. Right. So there are other people. Our own Linda Ellerby writes in and says, if you want people to stop minimizing COVID, stop talking about people's quote-unquote passing. People don't pass. People die.
I couldn't agree more with her. I've been meaning to bring that up on the program. I know that it's a stylistic issue and that people prefer to say pass because it somehow is less than dying. But dying is what it is. And I couldn't agree more with our wonderful Linda.
I agree also. Joe, don't you think it's going to make a big difference when you have a president of the United States who, I mean, empathy is one of his very strong suits, and particularly about, you know, given his own life experiences, empathy and death. And you've had a president who has not wanted to speak of this at all, and you're going to have a president-elect, and you can even see the shift now, who's talking about this and about loss and what it means to not have a person at the table on Sunday or holidays or whatever. And I think the more you have people in leadership positions talking about it, hopefully there will be a greater attention to it.
I think it certainly will help. I really like the letter that we got about a national program of mourning, of what you of how you do that, which doesn't have to be attached to any one faith, but just our overall human empathy, which as we've noted, can be absent. We just have about 10 minutes left, and we have I want to get to one or two more subjects before we leave. And I want to talk about the Georgia election. Obviously, this is coming up, and we're going to get into the holidays, and you'll blink, and then you'll be there. But here we are. Yesterday, it was a busy day on the campaign trail. Ivanka Trump was campaigning with Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue in Milton, Georgia, on Monday. Ms. Trump spoke about her father's record and the pandemic, but one of her biggest applause lines was about counting every single legal vote. Meanwhile, Kamala Harris, also in Georgia yesterday, who was campaigning with the Democratic candidates, the Reverend Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff. That is what just yesterday looked like in the race for the Senate. The two sides agree on the importance of the runoffs. Ms. Harris told the crowd in Columbus, a city in western Georgia, everything that was at stake in November is at stake on January 5th. Georgia will decide if our children grow up under an oppressive government or if America remains the land of the free, Harris said. Besides the shared sense of significance, the rallies had little in common. Mr. Perdue and Ms. Loeffler were both heckled by members of the audience who called on them to more forcefully back Mr. Trump's attempt to subvert the election. Some held signs calling for a special session of Congress to overturn the Electoral College vote, while others pushed the senators to vote against certifying the election results. In his remarks, Mr. Perdue nodded to the anger among those in the crowd whose voices were drowned out. Ms. Loeffler at one point yesterday said, I'm still fighting alongside him to make sure he finally gets a fair accounting in the state of Georgia. Wow, a lot going on there, Alan. How do you play it?
Well, you know, I've never had that much hope for the Democratic candidates. My predictions would be if anybody makes it, it's going to be Warnock. We don't know. We do know that there's a huge number of people out there who are voting. And voting by mail, whether this is because in reaction to what happened the last time, nobody wants to get, the Republicans don't want to get caught that way, or whether it was just an anti-Trump vote
and, you know, other Republicans won. So you know, to me, the fact that Biden went down, the fact that that Kamala Harris is there, indicates that they think that they've got a shot. But the but there's no question that the future of America lies in this election. We've never seen anything quite like it, in my view.
JP?
Yeah, I agree with Alan. This is really a turnout exercise, and Alan's right. You know, Donald Trump drove turnout for Republicans. He also significantly drove turnout for Democrats. So without him on the ticket, it's a really tough one to call. I wouldn't be surprised if Trump Republicans stay home and sit on their hands and the Democrats pull off one or two wins here. But I also wouldn't be surprised if the Republicans swept. It's very, very hard. These special elections where you have no idea who's turning out and how they're turning out are very, very hard to predict. And Alan is right, of course, that this is going to determine more than anything what kind of first term Joe Biden has. Will he have a Senate that can work with him, that he can pass legislation, or will he have a Senate led by Mitch McConnell who will be doing their best to stop any, you know, anything that's on his agenda?
Mike, what do you think, JP, I'm sorry, JP, what do you think of the yells from the crowd at these people for not having, at the Republicans, for not having stood with Trump more? Do you think that, I mean, a lot of Democrats found a great deal of solace and hope in that, that people, the Republicans, wouldn't turn out for that reason. What do you think?
I would, too, and that is specifically the reason, Alan, that I think that a number of Trump Republicans could sit on their hands and not vote. And it doesn't take a lot. It takes 2-4% of Republicans who say, you know what, this person isn't with Trump enough. Now, there will also be Democrats who don't turn out because Trump isn't on the top of the ticket, where they say, you know, we went out to get rid of Trump, and, you know, for whatever reason, they're not going to come out this time. But I agree with you on those shouts from the crowd. It doesn't take much on a couple right-wing websites to get to hurt their turnout. And if I was a Democratic operative, I'd be on those right-wing websites saying Loeffler and Perdue are not with Trump enough. They're not with them enough.
And the secret, it seems to me, for getting ahead here, the Democrats winning, is the black vote. I truly believe that. I think the choice of Warnock was brilliant. I mean, this is the preacher in Martin Luther King's church. And he's an incredibly great and articulate man. If that doesn't turn people out, I don't know what will.
Teresa?
Yeah, I agree that Reverend Warnock is, I've just been listening to his campaigning a bit, and just he's really inspiring and would be a wonderful addition of important voice in the Senate. But I just echo everything that JP said. I agree with all of that about turnout, and it's hard to understand what's going on. But I'm also concerned about, you know, the turnout is high, 1.4 million already, but fewer polling places in key locations. You know, the Republicans are up to doing what the Republicans do, which is try to dampen down the vote. Interesting to me about the stimulus package is one of the reasons they speculate that McConnell made sure to have a package go through is that he felt it would help in Georgia. Well, if they feel it'll help in Georgia, then why are they going to probably block future efforts? In any case, I think it's bottom line, turn out the vote. If Democrats can turn out the vote, they can win.
But you know what? Your outrage wasn't enough, in my mind. The outrage about, okay, we lost the last time, so we'll take polling places away. When we look back into the civil rights of this country and how people were asked to recite the Constitution and to do all of that, this is equally outrageous, isn't it?
It's despicable. The United States of America, if the only way you can win is to make every effort to block people from voting, it's absolutely despicable. And I understand that in some cases you just don't have enough workers, you don't have enough resources, but the governor, the election infrastructure, they could have had a more fulsome approach to this. And they've created such a worry for people about mail-in voting that people want to go and vote. You hear interview after interview about that. And they shouldn't have to be doing that in a pandemic, but they want to make sure their vote is counted. And now there are fewer places, which means longer lines. And at any time, it's not good, but in the midst of a pandemic, to make it harder for people to vote, create longer lines for people to vote in, it's shameful.
Well, we are out of time. I want to thank everybody who checked in this morning, and I know. I know.
Yeah. Goes quick, yeah. Doesn't it?
Think Tuberville.
You know, by the way, I just want to say, when after this Georgia election, I don't know about you, but you're probably going to see at least a 35 to 40% decrease in the amount of emails that you get in your inbox. I've never seen anything like it. Go ahead, Teresa.
Can we leave on a happy note, though? Because it's, brighter days are coming. We passed the solstice. Every day is brighter now for the rest of the year. So brighter days are coming.
Well, have a beautiful holiday, everybody.
Thank you for that.
Thanks so much. We'll see you all next week on that. We, of course, will be back tomorrow. Alan, thank you very much. Appreciate it,
thanks,
as always. And we'll return with the Congressional Corner right after this.